This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality and television host, Kerry Kasem. Kerry brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Kerry Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles. And everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com, I am Alan Gervy, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. I'm wearing glasses. I've never worn glasses in my life. I can't see a thing. Who is sitting across from me? Is that Kerry Kasem?
Yes. Actually, they're working.
They're not working. I'm just guessing.
Really?
For the last couple of weeks, I haven't seen you, and here you are in studio, in the flesh.
You got a haircut. You're wearing glasses. You look completely different.
I'm a different person.
And I got adjustment on my contacts as well.
Who do you know?
Who do I know?
Well, you're talking about your contacts. I always like a contact list. You know, seriously, these glasses, I'm taking them off. I can't see a thing in them. Oh, there you are. You look great.
You
look great. So you've been traveling all over the world, and we've missed you. You were in South Africa, right?
I was, and then Florida.
And Florida.
I was supposed to be in Washington, but...
To see the bushes.
No. Yeah, no.
I love when you tell me off the air, whatever you do, don't mention my meeting with the bushes. And what is the first thing I do when we're on the air?
You mention it.
I do.
Yeah, so it's the bushes out in South Africa. I was in the bush.
Bush
it was
country.
Amazing. And I got to pet a cheetah.
Who's Laura Bush, by the way?
Part of the Bush family,
okay.
Right? So, yeah, but I got to pet a cheetah. Did you know that, and I knew this before going in, they're one of the only big cats to purr?
Of course I did. I spent a lot of times with cheetahs.
You're so full of it.
I'm not. What did I do on my honeymoon? We went to South Africa.
You
I spent
did?
2 weeks.
I didn't know this.
Well, we did the same thing that you did with the cheetahs, and then we touched the, played with the lions and everything. Yeah. Been there, done that.
All right, fine.
It was fun.
Yeah.
You had a great time, though.
I had a fantastic time.
I love the
time.
Pictures.
But I can't sleep now. I have horrible insomnia. If anybody listening to this knows a cure, natural cure for insomnia, find me on Instagram.
Well, there's someone sitting beside you, and I think he may have some input on taking drugs and maybe taking too many drugs and what some cures and treatment might be for certain conditions. So we're going to get to that later because it's pretty interesting. And folks, you won't want to miss, and I'm just going to let the cat out of the bag, so to speak, since we're talking about cheetahs. Harry Nelson will be on the show shortly. We're going to talk to Harry Nelson, who is a leading healthcare attorney, probably the best healthcare attorney that I know, and I know a lot of them. And he has a book coming up soon, The United States of Opioids. So you want to hear that. And later on the show, we have Scott Zoller, straight from Atlanta, Georgia. And Scott is going to tell us about an interesting case. You know about the case, Kerry, because you are a pet lover. I'm not.
Alan.
Go ahead, Kerry. Tell us about Scott's case.
That's, you know, horrible. No, I mean, honestly, and I've read about this, it's not just Scott's case, but when you have a pet that gets away and the shelter picks him up and...
And then they kill him.
But they don't wait. Oh, it was our mistake. A mistake. You've just killed a member of my family.
Exactly.
There should be penalties.
And in Scott's case, his client had three dogs that were put down. We're going to hear from Scott and what's going to happen in that case in Atlanta, Georgia, a leading case regarding pet euthanasia, which is awful. We have some exciting news, of course.
I'm waiting.
So you don't have a clue what happens in our show, do you?
I actually read what Genevieve gave me.
No, I'm not talking about
but
that.
But there's
I'm talking
a lot of exciting news.
What is the most exciting news?
Okay, so I don't know if it's exciting, but it's happening.
Years.
It's happening. We have changed times and days.
We are doing that. We're going to make the announcement right now. This is the first time ever anyone has ever in the wide world heard of what is happening to Gervy's Law. After 5 years, Gervy's Law is moving to a new day and a new time. Isn't that right,
Kerry? Sounds like NBC or ABC or CBS, you know. We're moving to a new day and new time. Your favorite
exactly
show is going to be
case.
On Sunday at 5 o'clock.
We are so excited to announce, Carrie, that we are moving to Sundays at 5 p.m. No more Saturdays. I can now go to my kids' baseball
yes.
games and dance classes and do everything I've always wanted to do with my kids, because we will be here Sunday at 5 just for your listening pleasure, one-on-ones with the most interesting guests all over the world right here on Gurry's Law. Sundays at 5 p.m. Mark it in your calendars. New day, new time.
That's right. Exciting.
It is exciting, and we'll talk more about it as we go along. But let's turn our attention to Harry, because Harry's sitting here very patiently, and I mentioned that Harry Nelson, and he started this firm. How do you start a firm, Harry? You're the founding partner, right, of your firm?
Yeah. Yeah, when I came out to California 18 years ago, I was a eighth-year lawyer, and I joined a solo practitioner who was defending doctors getting in trouble before medical boards and government agencies, and I just started giving advice on some of these tricky compliance issues, and my name started getting out there, and one lawyer and then another lawyer, and we're 30 lawyers now, so it's...
Wow.
We're the biggest in LA, and it's been fun.
And you're the founding partner. It's Nelson Hardiman, of course.
Yep.
Now, you have written all kinds of things. You're kind of a go-to guy when it comes to healthcare. How did you become interested in the healthcare industry? And why do you think that you, as a lawyer, can play a doctor in a book and play a doctor on TV and in the radio right here?
You sound like my kids. My kids are always making fun of me for sounding,
oh, they don't make fun of
for,
you
for
Harry.
Sounding like a doctor. So, you know, I got into healthcare kind of accidentally. I worked in Washington in college in the, one summer for a congressman, and then I came back really fascinated by the regulatory agencies that ran America. So I decided I wanted to do regulatory law. I went to a small firm in Chicago, was doing work for colleges and universities, and it was in the early 90s when everything going on was about all the healthcare change. It was after Hillary Care failed, but all these HIPAA and a lot of new laws were coming into place. So I started doing that work, and then my firm broke up in Chicago. My wife dragged me out here. She was from here.
Terrible.
And
awful.
I think I was in the right place when a lot of things were happening. And the last 20 years, almost 20 years out in California, it's been a crazy time. The opioid crisis being a small piece of it, but just a lot of transformation in healthcare, Obamacare, all of it.
And when you talk about that, I just quickly want to mention your previous book in 2017, because you talk about Obamacare and you talk about Trump Care, Obamacare to Trump Care.
Why you should care.
Why you should care. I love the title. I love Why You Should Care. And that focused on the recent and past future U.S. health policy. But of course, it's more than that. It's political. When you look at the progression, Obamacare and whatever you want to call it, Trump Care or whatever, which is probably non-existent at this point, tell us why our country has gotten into the crisis that ends up in a book like The United States of Opioids.
It's a big question. I think our healthcare system is badly broken. We spend more money than any country in the world for bad outcomes. We have our life expectancy. You look at any disease state, diabetes, heart disease, we just look much worse, not only than developing countries, but certainly than anybody in the advanced industrialized world. The lifespan of Americans is getting shorter. So partly it's that our financial incentives are screwed up.
Yes.
And partly it's that Americans don't like to take responsibility. So there's a different ethic here. We smoke more than other people. We are the fattest people in the world, and myself included. And we live under way too much stress. We don't live healthy lives. And our system has just been set up to keep enabling that and spending a lot of money on end of life expensive care and not getting people early on with healthy preventive living.
I'm so sick of hearing we're living so much longer these days. Every time I hear that, I just straight up look at the person and say, really, who's living longer? One out of three people get cancer. And I said, the people who are living longer have eaten the non-GMO food, have not had as many vaccinations as we have now, have not, and I'm not anti-vax here, guys. It's just 38 vaccinations by the time you're 18 months doesn't make any sense to me. But, you know, I was vaccinated, what, 6 or 7 shots by then? I mean, you're looking at all the medication people are on. The people are not being told, eat right. You're being told, take this pill. And people are dying at a faster rate. We are dying. We have more dementia. We have more diseases that used to get when you were 50, 60, 70. Now you're getting treating them in the 20s and the 30s, autoimmune diseases. So I'm so sick of hearing we are living longer. And you're the first person that has actually come on the show and said we are dying younger. And that is so true.
Yeah, it's really scary. The last 2 years in particular, we've actually seen reductions in the lifespan. A lot of people think it's tied to overdose deaths and suicides and all of the problems around addiction, but I agree with you. It's a whole, it's a zillion things that are going wrong in that are making us unhealthier than ever.
Absolutely, and I do look at the people who are in their 80s, are in their 90s, and they lived a completely different life than what we're living now. The pollution alone, the pesticides we're using in our homes, the food that we're eating, the medicines we're taking, it's not helping us. We are living in a very toxic society, and now, you know, with all the pills that everybody prescribing instead of a healthy diet, I'm really worried.
I'm getting really choked up.
you're coughing over there.
I'm coughing, really choked up. But Harry, I want to ask you. You mentioned a really significant word when you were talking a few minutes ago. Money. I mean, isn't money the root of all of this evil that you're talking about? In a lot of different senses, we're going to talk about big pharma. We'll talk about, you know, the money involved, the legislation. In my line of work in workers' compensation, we see so many money interest groups having an impact on the legislation in the workers' compensation arena regarding healthcare. And you start wondering, when are we ever going to realize that there's so many influences from money interests that we as individuals, what Carrie talks about, has no control over?
Yeah, no question. It's broken. The drug companies, frankly, the incentives on physicians ever since more than 50 years into the Medicare program, creating just a fund that hospitals and nursing homes and doctors just bill. And whether it's government programs, whether it's employers, everybody is trying to make as much money as possible rather than trying to keep people healthy.
And of course, the lobbying that takes place for these legislators, and Karen knows a little bit about this because
my foundation.
I was going to say your mother's husband is a lobbyist. So, but when you look at it and you look at the wrong principles, the insurance companies and how the denials take place on situations when there shouldn't be denials, and then there is authorizations when maybe there shouldn't be authorizations. How do we rein in these insurance companies, utilization reviews, all of these things to be able to provide effective health care, not health care based on money interests?
It's not an easy answer. We have to eliminate, there's a lot of fraud and waste and abuse, just unnecessary care that's being given because it's in the best interest of the provider rather than the patient. A big piece of the answer is end-of-life care. We have, you know, I heard somebody say a joke recently about cancer care that, you know, why do they put nails in the coffin to stop the oncologist from treating the patient? We spend 70%, over 70% of most people's healthcare life expense is spent in their last year of life.
Wow.
So the answer isn't in one place. It's in a lot of places, and trying to figure out how to actually make sure that we're only paying for effective care.
Effective care, not expensive care.
We are paying for expensive care.
Well, that goes without saying. And I want to talk after the break, because we have to take a quick break, about your new book, The United States of Opioids, Liberating a Nation in Pain. There's so many loaded questions that come along with a book like this. And I know that there aren't easy answers. If there were, we wouldn't be in this quagmire that just keeps getting worse and worse. And I think that's something that you would echo. Before we go to the break, I do want to mention, the book comes out in March, right?
Yeah, March 7th it's out.
And Lisa Marie Presley said about the book, Harry has written a powerful book. The United States of Opioids is a call to action and tangible steps that we can all take. Harry delivers insights into the challenges facing our health system, doctors, hospitals, and addiction treatment providers, but also offers steps that we can all take as parents and with everyone else in our lives. Now, that's really putting a lot of pressure on you, and we're going to find out how you do this in your book, The United States of Opioids, after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, lifting Murphy's Law to the highest level on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. We're talking to Harry Nelson. The book is called The United States of Opioids, Liberating a Nation in Pain. It's going to be out for everyone to read in a short while in March. And Harry is the founding and managing partner of Nelson Hardiman, which is a leading healthcare law firm. And he's nationally known as one of the thought leaders in this area of law, healthcare. Now, Harry, before the break, I talked about someone who had commented on your book, Lisa Marie Presley, and someone who wrote the foreword in your book. You have actually talked to Lisa Marie about her issues, and how have you been able to help and get her motivated to help you?
Yeah, after I decided to write this book, I reached out to a bunch of people because I thought that, you know, people in the healthcare world may know me, but certainly not in the broader society. And I had a message I wanted to get heard. And a lot of people said to me, I asked people if they would talk about their experiences, personal experiences with addiction. And a lot of people said no to me. But Lisa said that she was willing to do it. First, she said she would think about it. And then she actually went on the Today Show with Laura Bush.
Yeah.
and we were talking about Laura Bush before the break.
And she shared her own story. And my point to Lisa and to a number of other people who I can't say yet, but I believe are going to be in the coming weeks and months sharing their stories, is that the more that people who we all look up to and think of as the great successes of our society actually open up about their own experiences with addiction and with all the issues around it, it's really a chance to help people and to make room for everybody to acknowledge that that these things are happening around us and we need to be worried about them and thinking about how to deal with them.
I have a family member who was horribly addicted to opioids, and it was horrible to watch over 10 to 15 years until, you know, we had an intervention and they stopped. I don't want to say stop, but they had to come very slowly off of them, and they're on another drug that is helping them get off the other drug. And it's like, wow, it's a very slow, long, arduous process to get off of these drugs. And it's very scary, but it's affected not only like my family, but friends of mine. And there was a man I dated very long time ago, 20 something years ago. And I didn't realize that, you know, Lauricet and all these, you know, Vicodin, and it was a big wake up call for me, were drugs. And they were like heroin. And I had no idea. And I'm in a lot of pain. And he's taking them all the time, but he's completely high all the time. And I didn't realize I was literally in a relationship with a drug addict. And even though it was legal, it was still a drug addict. So I've come across this in my own life. What do you do about it? How do you talk about it without sitting down and having that intervention when it gets too late?
Well, I think it's critical to talk to people, to be engaged with each other without, and to express concern without judgment, without blame, without criticism. The reality is we have 20 million adults in America, which is 1 in 12 adults in the U.S., self-describes as having a substance use disorder, a drug problem, including addiction. And so it's a massive, it's every family. And so the question is, how can you raise the issue with people and let them know that you're worried without making them more ashamed?
Right. And making them feel bad or making them wrong. And of course, I'm in pain. Instant defense. Well, no, you're not yourself anymore. You've become a drug addict, and you can't really say it in those terms. You have to be very careful.
Harry, from the doctor's perspective, when you talk about someone prescribing these medications, as Carrie's referring to, why is it so easy for doctors to prescribe? And I know there have been a lot of legislation, regulations, when they talk about triplicates and things for prescriptions that are making it a little more difficult. But when you go to a doctor's office and Carrie says, I'm in pain, the doctors really don't have answers, do they? Their answer is to take out their script and say, here's some oxycodone, go out of here.
Yeah, I had a doctor tell me recently, this is something I mentioned in the book, he says, it takes 30 seconds to say yes when a patient asks for a prescription. It takes 30 minutes to say no and explain why not.
Great quote.
The thing that I saw in putting this book together, I started doing a little bit of research, and what we've seen is a massive pendulum swing. If you went back 100 years ago, we were in the middle of a massive crackdown. Basically, for most of the 1800s, people were getting opioids, getting heroin. Bayer sold heroin before they sold aspirin. Yeah. And people were using opioids for everything. And then we had this, they became illegal. We started cracking down sending doctors to jail. And then what happened was the pendulum swung back by the 70s and 80s. The issue was pain and all the chronic pain. 50 million Americans report that they have chronic pain some or most days. I mean, like 1 in 5 adults.
Wow.
And so what happened was we had the pendulum swing. The government started ordering hospitals to survey patients on pain. Pain became the fifth vital sign. And then what happened was the opioid crisis. People started dying and the pendulum swung back. And the problem is that doctors haven't been trained in medical school either how to treat pain or how to deal with addiction. So we're really trying to ask all of our doctors to learn right now. And we don't even have standards.
When you say learn, what are you asking them to learn? Because we don't see, if it's someone like an orthopedist, they may not have a lot of interest in a multidisciplinary pain program. For instance, they are not looking at saying you need to do this kind of training, a Swiss ball training or Pilates, or you need a personal trainer, or you need to go to a gym, or you need to do massage or chiropractic or acupuncture. All of these non-opioid approaches to pain. Why would an orthopedic surgeon talk about that?
Right. I mean, the quote I always come back to is, if you have a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And if you go to the spine surgeon, they're not going to talk to you about, hey, maybe Pilates or meditation.
Aaron Filler will. That's one guy who's a neurosurgeon that will actually suggest every single thing. And he wrote a book, and I want people to know this, called Do You Really Need Back Surgery? That's what he makes his living off of.
But no, he doesn't. He's a thoracic outlet specialist.
I know him, too. I did a radio show with him for a year.
Really?
Yes. And so he always says to me, and he said, you've got to try everything first before you go under the knife. Always.
Well, that's true. And that's what he says. But, you know, he's not the neurosurgeon.
He was training neurosurgeons over at Cedars-Sinai. So we did this. This is a long time ago, long time ago. So I don't know how,
talk about things, the thoracic outlet, for instance, which Dr. Filler is the guy.
He's amazing.
But it's a painful experience when you have these kind of conditions, chronic pain syndromes, fibromyalgia, whatever it might be. But I want to hear, Harry, when you talk about alternatives, because that's what this book, The United States of Opioids, you're addressing the epidemic of opioids and the addiction and what it has caused pain in so many families, literally and figuratively. What are the alternatives when we have this medical system, the healthcare system set up to go in for 15, 20 minutes? The doctors complain they don't get paid. They're not going to spend a half an hour, for instance, to try and address these issues. What do you do?
I don't have the magic answer. I'll tell you, it's really tough. What's happening, by the way, I work with a lot of pain doctors, and what they'll tell you is they have patients they've been seeing for 10 years, 20 years, who are on 250 methadone equivalents, MMEs is the standard. Today, they won't prescribe people at more than a third of that level. So a lot of people can't get the help. So the answer, what can you do for people? It really, you know, there's a lot of the answer is in the exactly all these alternative therapies we've been talking about. A huge part of the answer for many people is actually mind-body work addressing the stress that's causing the pain.
Exactly.
And then one of the things I tried to talk about in the book is, you know, cannabis and other things. There's kratom, a lot of things that are out there other than opioids.
CBD.
What's kratom?
Kratom is a substance coming from Asia that's been coming into the country. The government's been looking at it and trying to decide whether to regulate it. Right now, it's a supplement. I have a friend who said to me, I had a bike accident. For 10 years, I've been taking Vicodin 10 milligrams a day. It's been fine for me. My doctor cut me off because he's afraid of, you know, the crackdown on doctors prescribing opioids. And kratom, I take kratom now. Kratom works. So, you know, I have a web page up on Facebook for my book, and kratom has become a huge thing. CBD and all the different cannabinoids are a big piece of the picture.
Is kratom a supplement?
It comes out of an Asian plant, but it has effects like opioids. The thing about opioids is we have these receptors in our bodies where opioids help you reduce pain. You feel euphoric, and they slow your breathing.
I feel like I'm going to throw up. I can't take anything opioid. I'm sick immediately. I don't know how people are like, oh, it feels like high. I'm like, I need to run to the toilet.
So a lot of different opioid effects.
It's true.
affect different people differently. You're not the only one. I had the same experience when I was given Vicodin for kidney stone years ago. But unfortunately, the people who are in trouble are the people who try it and have that, this is
euphoric feeling.
This is it. I've been waiting for this.
But there isn't enough of these people out there. When you talk about the practitioners who understand the alternatives, they're not getting approved by insurance companies. It's almost like a re-education of our whole healthcare system, because what do? We go to an orthopedic surgeon, we go to an internist, we go to a neurologist. These people are not treating pain the way you're suggesting.
Yeah, I really think people need to do their own research. There's a lot of new stuff coming out. There are huge numbers of device companies coming out with products to try and stop that pain impulse shooting from the nerve. So there's not one answer. The hardest piece of this whole puzzle is what to do with all of the people out there in pain. And I think the bottom line is people need to do their research and not expect that any one doctor is going to hold all the answers.
Right. And also what you said, and I think Carrie agrees with, when you address the emotional and psychological perspective, things like biofeedback, relaxation therapies, things to deal with your mind. Pain is in the brain, as they say, central nervous system, sensitization. When you talk about that, it's not just peripheral. So you have to deal with the brain and deal with readjusting thinking and emotions. Wouldn't you agree with that?
100%. So a lot of the talk in the opioid crisis discussion has been, how do we stop doctors from overprescribing? How do we get the heroin off the streets? How do we control the fentanyl flowing in from China and Mexico? And I think the answer really is all these underlying issues. It's how do you address them? And there's a study that came out a few months ago from University of Pittsburgh that blew my mind. It showed that the last 40 years, we have this tight exponential rising curve of overdose deaths from all drugs. So if you actually, it's a pop-up, a push-down pop-up problem, meaning like if you clamp down on meth, people move to coke. You clamp down on coke, people move to opioids.
Yep.
You eliminate the heroin and people go to fentanyl. So the only way we're going to solve it is asking what's underneath, what is the emotional pain and the stress that's driving people to such lengths.
And education plays a big part of it. Reading a book like The United States of Opioids helps. And you talk about celebrities who are in the limelight, in the media, the Michael Jackson situation. How did that impact so many people? And what was your involvement with that?
So I, because I got very involved in when I came to LA and working with doctors in trouble, I worked with a lot of doctors who had their own issues and then retrained into addiction medicine. And so what I started getting calls after celebrity deaths, because once it hit the front page of the paper, you could be sure that the police and the medical board were on it. So when Michael Jackson died, I got calls from several doctors who called me and were panicked and said, I wrote prescriptions under fake names. What do I do? And one of the things that really drove me to write this book was one of those doctors. I spent an hour and a half on the phone with him trying to calm him down and tell him it was going to be okay. We were going to work our way through it and do the work that I do, which is trying to get people to show that they understand what went wrong and that they can do things the right way. And in this case, I learned the next day that the doctor had decided he had panicked and overdosed himself.
Wow.
And so I've been involved in the overdose deaths of many, many celebrities, Anna Nicole Smith, Whitney Houston and Prince's case with the providers who took care of these people. So for me, the question is like, what are the lessons that we can learn? It's so sad that these people who we look at as having achieved more than anybody, living in so much pain and then be able to pay for any care that they could get, and yet getting care that led to their deaths.
Yeah,
that is really some of the interesting stuff, really. And hopefully books like this will help people understand it better, and that money will be put into not into the drugs, but into preventing people from abusing the drugs.
And I have to say one thing, Alan, the people that I have talked to, and there's certain doctors, some will understand that they can go the healthy route, and some actually get upset and they feel that the medical way and pills and this is the only way to go. And I think that there needs to be some kind of nutrition and some kind of program in schools when you're going for a doctorate degree to train these
Carrie,
people.
We got to take a break, but I'm going to agree with what you say. And I'm going to say again what I said before, which was the money.
Yeah.
Watch the money trail and then you'll understand people's motivations. And I think that's discussed in the book. The book is called United States of Opiates, Liberating a Nation in Pain. He is Harry Nelson. Nelson. This is a prescription for liberating a nation in pain. It's going to be available in March?
Yeah, right, okay. First week of March.
Okay, great. Well, maybe we can have you come back and talk a little bit more about it in a couple months. It's a great book that you need to read to get a hold of this whole awful situation that we're immersed in. Harry Nelson is at Nelson Hardiman, the firm. Good luck with that, and thanks for coming on Gurry's Law today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Now we're going to talk after the break with Scott Zoller, and we're going to talk about pet euthanasia and murdering pets. Terrible.
Kitties.
Be right back.
Welcome back to Gurvey's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. You're listening to Gurvey's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. I'm here with Carrie Kasem, and she's moving to the groove.
I'm dancing.
You know, our next guest, Carrie, you're just going to really fall in love with. I'll tell you, I know you, it's just an area that is so close, near and dear to your heart. Animals and pets, you've spent your life advocating for
yes.
animals. You know, we always talk, in other shows, we've talked about your pets. And of course, you had this
My
year was very
kitty.
Unfortunate.
Yes.
That you lost your
20-year-old child. Cat.
And you have something in common with our next guest because he lost his dog, Zoe, had him 15 years, wonderful, great, great dog, and lost him this year, unfortunately, in October. I want to introduce to everyone right now Scott Zoller. He is one of the top attorneys in the state of Georgia. He's in Atlanta, and he has a very important case right now. Dealing with the death of three dogs, the murder, I guess we can say. And Scott, first of all, you know, I've known you for so long. I haven't ever had you on the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. Scott Zoller, welcome to Gurvey's Law.
Thanks, Alan. Great to be on the show. Hey, Carrie.
Hi.
And Happy New Year to both of you.
Yeah, same to you. Can we still say that? It's like...
Yes, I've been saying it.
Say that for really.
I don't know how long, but you know, you went to Brown University, so you should know these things. This is things that Ivy League students should learn.
I think I missed class that day.
I bet you did, Scott.
Actually,
you missed quite a bit. You were busy doing a lot of things. Scott's an accomplished baseball player, done a lot of things. But let me ask you this, Scott. You know, you became a lawyer, and one of the things I know, you have a big heart, and lawyers often don't get the credit for really helping people and thinking about their lives. In this particular case, your client, and I don't know how to pronounce it, John Amadinia, that's his name. Yeah. So, you know, he lost his dogs. Tell us what happened and why you feel this is such an important issue that you really need to go to the mat on.
Sure. Well, first of all, Carrie, I'm sorry to hear about your dog.
It was my cat.
Yeah, your cat.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Thanks.
I actually lost both my dogs last year, and I was utterly devastated, and I carry the pain and heartache with me every day of my life. And they were my first children, like your cat was
yes.
your child. And
yes.
they're beloved and cherished family members, and I had them for 15 years, and there's a huge void in my life. So
that's how I feel.
I totally understand what you're going through. This case, so pets and animals, dogs and cats, are near and dear to my heart as well. And this case involves my client who basically owned he owns a mattress company here in Atlanta, which is very profitable. And at that mattress factory, he has three dogs. He had three dogs, Lucy, Back, and Princess, who were guard dogs, but they were also family dogs as well. They would be taken home on the weekends, and his children just loved the dogs. So what happened was, back on December 9th, 2016, a woman called the police claiming that the three dogs attacked and bit her, and Fulton County Animal Control came and basically impounded the dogs, and they were impounded pending a court date to basically find out what happened, to determine if the dogs were dangerous and vicious and whether or not they were a danger to others. And I actually defended Mr. Amendini on that case. And before we even got to trial, when we went to the trial on January 18th, the judge asked how the dogs were doing, and Mr. Amendini was told for the first time by Lifeline, which was the place that they were being impounded that the dogs had been put down 2 weeks earlier. Mr. Amendino was never told this. He was never notified of this. He found out in open court.
Wait a second, Scott. That first time he heard, he assumed that the dogs were doing okay. And hadn't he been in contact with Lifeline and they were saying the dogs were fine?
Yeah, correct. First of all, they were supposed to be impounded for 10 days, which turned into 6 weeks. During that time, he would go visit the dogs or try to visit the dogs and was repeatedly told that the dogs are fine, you can't see them because they're in quarantine, and they wouldn't even let him bring medication to one of his dogs, which was prescribed by the vet. So he was continuously told the dogs were fine, there was no problems, just, you know, they're being taken care of, they're okay. And after hearing that, then we come to find out later on that the dogs had been put down 2 weeks before the hearing, and yet they never told him. So the first time he found out, he had the indignity of finding out in open court. And that's not the way you want to find out that your dogs have been killed, basically.
Please tell me that you've won a big lawsuit against these people who've done this. This is evil.
Well, the lawsuit was actually filed several weeks ago, and I hope to win a big lawsuit. That's my goal. But my larger goal is to change law here in Georgia, which is like the law most everywhere else, which basically coldly treats dogs and pets as property, and the only recovery you can get is basically the fair market value of the dogs. You can't recover emotional damages or not economic damages, and as most people know, dogs are family members.
Yes.
And there's a lot of emotional ties and companionship when you lose a loved one, a loved family member. So that's my greater goal in this case.
So, Scott, when you say that the damages are limited in that way, what do you have to do to prove that the dog is worth more than what you're saying is just what you paid for it or what the fair market value? How do you even put a fair market value on a dog?
Well, the latest, there was a case that was decided 2 years ago here in Georgia and went up to the Supreme Court. And basically, the Supreme Court decided in that case that the fair market, that a jury can consider what the fair market value of the dog is, and what they can consider is the breed, the age, the training, the temperament, and the use of the dog. And they can also consider, you know, what vet bills were used or incurred to save a dog's life, okay? Meaning, and those are in cases involving negligence where, say, a boarding place or a veterinarian gives the dog the wrong medication, which is what happened in that case, and the dog dies. My case is different because in my case, I believe that given the cover-up and the fact that they kept telling him the dogs were fine when the dogs were actually dead and some other information we have, I believe they were blatantly lying to him. I believe that they covered this up. And if they had told him that the dogs were being euthanized, there's a requirement under Georgia law that they give him written notification of that so that he can appeal it. If he had appealed it, the judge in this case would have certainly not allowed them to euthanize the dog. So they basically proceeded without an adjudication that the dogs were dangerous, which is what they need. They need that authority to then go ahead and euthanize dangerous dogs.
Did these dogs actually bite this woman? Was she in the wrong? Did she go into something? And then what happened exactly?
Yeah, what I proved during the trial, he had 12 citations for these dogs. We tried the case a month later, and basically what I proved was this woman was lying. She had a long history of criminal activity, should I say, including, you know, certain crimes of deception and fraud. And we had surveillance video that basically showed that two of the dogs got out, and they were either sitting in front of the gate, the fence, or strolling back and forth. And one of the dogs never even left the compound, you know, the premises. So basically I proved the woman was lying, and I think she was just trying to fabricate a claim to get a big payday, and all charges were dismissed against my client. The dogs were found not to be dangerous.
Can you go after her as well? She needs to go to jail.
Why?
She's evil.
But unfortunately, there's nothing to go after.
Yeah, I'm sure there's nothing. But, and the dogs, there are two Rottweilers and a German Shepherd, right?
I just have a question to both lawyers, you, Alan, and Scott. Why can somebody do that and not have any penalties?
Well, I mean, Yeah, there is a penalty for making frivolous charges, both criminal and civil. But that's up to the DAs. I mean, the judge heard it all, and that's up for the DA, the district attorney.
Yeah. So it's a good question, Carrie. It involves fraud. It involves the DA. You can turn it over, and they can do an investigation. But I think what Scott was concerned about, not that he wasn't concerned about this fraudulent accusation, but he was more concerned about really what happened over at Lifeline Animal Project. To me, Scott, it boggles the mind that they would put dogs down without court order or without the owner's knowledge. How do they get away with that? And I know they said it was a mistake. Can they plead that, we made a mistake. We didn't mean to. We just got confused.
First of all, they've never directly apologized to my client for this. Number two, they had an investigative reporter. I tried to find out what happened. I tried to talk to Lifeline about this once we found out the dogs were put down. I talked to the director. She gave me the runaround. She referred me back to the solicitor. And basically, she would not tell me why the dogs were put down, when they were put down. I did a Public Records Act request. And then only then, when they were compelled to produce this information, did I find out the date the dogs were put down, which was on, which was 2 weeks before the hearing. And I got the euthanasia record, which showed it, but I still didn't know why they did it. An investigative reporter is the one who found out that the dogs were basically a judge in another case had ordered three other dogs to be put down, and they claim that they made a mistake and mistook these three dogs for the other three dogs. However, wow. When you look at the euthanasia report and the record, all six dogs were put down. So if it was actually a mistake, the other three dogs
would still be living.
Right, exactly.
So,
wow.
So just a lot of shady activity going on here. And
well, first of all, Scott,
discovery in this case that this may have happened before.
Why
find out?
Why are they when you filed this case, why didn't they call you up and say, listen, we need to talk. We need to settle this. We need to get this out of the media. Scott Zoller shouldn't be on Gervie's Law right now talking about it because it really makes Lifeline Animal Project look terrible. Why don't they close this place down if they can't figure out how to handle these furry friends?
Well, after I sent a demand letter to them, I did get a call from their lawyer, and he basically offered me the fair market value of the dogs, or his estimation of the fair market value. I think the offer was $10,000.
Wow.
That's horrible.
Probably would pay more than that, but I want to try this case. As I said before, this is a quest for me, given how I feel about my dogs and other people's dogs and how badly I feel for my client. I mean, imagine, a lot of people can prepare themselves for the death of a dog or a cat, and they know it's coming, and when that day comes, it's horrible, but at least they can, have the comfort of family members, the veterinarian to help them out. But the way he learned about it was just so horrible, and the way they lied to him was just so incredible. It, like you said, Alan, it boggles the mind, honestly.
Now, you're trying to change the law there? In Georgia?
Well, I would like to, the law here is evolving, actually. There are some states, it's a minority rule, but some states actually allow for for non-economic damages for the loss of the companionship of a dog.
Yeah.
I think Tennessee has a $5,000 cap on it. My last dog, who passed away in October, in the last 8 months of her life, I had eight different veterinarians involved in her care.
Wow.
A number of specialists, and kind of a running joke at my vet's office, and they've been there for 40 years, is they all say that if they come back into their life, they want to be my dog.
That's like my cat. I did everything.
It really gives them the point of how much my life revolved around these dogs. Yeah.
And you're not the only one. We're going to have to stop it here, Scott, but we really do wish you all the best as you pursue justice for your client. They'll never bring the dogs back, but if you can change the law and if people can recognize how important their pets are and how these organizations should not get away with this, that will be doing everyone a service.
Yeah, I mean, dogs are not appliances, are not fungible. you know, products. They mean a lot more to people than just, you know, a toaster or a car or a TV set. So,
all right, yep. Scott.
I hope so too, and that's my goal in this case.
Well, good luck with that. Yeah, and thank you for what you're doing. Hopefully you'll keep us up to date as the discovery continues and hopefully get to trial soon to get some justice. Thanks for being with us today, Scott.
I appreciate your support, and thanks for having
me
on.
Okay, take care.
Thanks.
So, Carrie, we only have a couple minutes, a minute left. I want to reiterate the big news that we released today. So you know now what the big news is. Yes. As you smile at me. What's the big news, Carrie?
So we're moving Gervie's Law from Saturday afternoon to Sunday early evening at 5 o'clock, and that's going to start February 10th.
February 10th, yes. Our first day, Sunday, 5 p.m., folks. Gervie's Law, February 10th, Sunday.
Yay.
5 p.m. I'm so excited.
New bat time, new bat channel.
Yeah, I can't say same bat time, same bat channel anymore. We will see you Sunday, February 10th at 5 p.m. right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.